But I remember years ago hearing a song he did, Got to Tell Someone, which puts this story in a really human sort of context, where something as powerful as that, and then Jesus says, now keep it quiet. There's a girl who is dead, and suddenly she's not, and he says, keep it quiet. I mean, how do you cover that up? You can't, can you? I want to go through the three characters. I don't want to focus on Jesus' point of view. I want to look at the three individuals to see if we can relate to any of them. And I think we probably can. At different times in our lives, we can relate to all three. And I'm going to kind of move backwards through the story. So I'm going to start with the little girl. Now, we're told after she's back alive that she's 12. Now, a Jewish audience would have seen that as very significant, because that was the turning point from girlhood to womanhood. This is regarded as the key moment in her life, the moment that is full of potential and the future and hope and all of those things. But she's dying. In fact, halfway through the story, she's dead. So hope in the human world is squashed. Now, I reckon probably every single one of us at different times in our life, we have felt we felt so close to death in different ways. We felt that we are entirely helpless. A young girl, certainly back then in that society, confined to bed because of her illness that is getting worse and worse, she is entirely dependent upon her family. We're not very good at being dependent. We like to do things in our own strength. Now, we live in a society that is so full of freedom. I don't know if you remember a series on TV a little while ago called The World's Strictest Parents. I take great delight in showing my year nines some of these. I think most of you know I'm a teacher. So I sit them down in front of a particularly extreme version of the world's strictest parents. And there's this lovely Irish family that take in a couple of Australian sort of delinquents, really. They're coming from dysfunctional families. And they suddenly come into this family where mum and dad have got a very clear, very rigid structure. There is discipline. There are at the core of the family is their faith, and they all know exactly where they are, and the family strength is incredible. And you see the transforming impact of this family life, and that's all it is really, it's just family life as it should be. You see how it transforms these two wayward teenagers who've never known anything but total freedom to do their own thing. And of course, our year nines sit there, and they completely side with the teenagers, at least for the first 90 minutes. These awful parents, what do you mean you can't wear those? What do you mean you can't have a face piercing? What do you mean you can't wear those to school? They just can't get their head around, because they have come from a culture where they are given massive amounts of freedom. And it's not politically correct now to challenge that. But at the core of the Christian teaching is this family, this idea that mum and dad make the rules. Children, honour your parents. It's way back there in Exodus, 10 commandments, one of the 10. You think of all the rules and regs that could have got into the 10, but that is there because it is so important. And I think it's something which young people really, really need. They need strong parents who love them enough to discipline and to show them the meaning of it. And so we have youngsters who do their own thing. And the thought of being totally dependent on somebody else, and we take that into adulthood with us, the thought of being dependent on someone else, it's like a terrible thing. This young girl has been there. She knows it. And she's getting iller and iller. to have the faith to believe in something different, that this could change. I'm not talking about from a dad's point of view. I'm going to come to him in a minute. But for her to believe. We don't know what she believes. We don't know where she is in her walk with God. You know, she's a passive person in this story. But I think we can relate to her reliance on others at times in our life. And it's not a comfortable place to be. In the middle of the story, we have the woman who's bleeding. And that's a sort of a polite way of saying that she's got quite severe or serious menstrual issues. And that, of course, would have had big implications, again, for the Jewish society. She would have been permanently classed as unclean, and therefore pretty much an outcast. So to simply to come into the crowd and to mix with the crowds, that took courage. She has tried everything. You know, I love the way Mark, he sort of takes a bit of a snipe at the doctors. He says, you know, she's been to the doctors and got worse. You know, this world has tried. She has tried what this world has got to offer. And she got worse. And she hears this rumors of this guy, this healer. And she's desperate. Now, there are many of us who simply do not have the courage to take that chance. I remember many years ago as a student, and this is a really risky thing to do, so I'm not advocating it as a way of life, but we had, as part of our Christian fellowship that we had at uni, there was a Roman Catholic girl. And she literally had a withered hand, and I can't remember why or what had happened to it, but her hand was all sort of stunted and everything. And you know, we back then, you know, as a young Christian, you believe that you can raise the dead and heal the sick and everything, and you know, you're going to change the world. And as I said, I'm not advocating this as a something that should be explored in every circumstance, but I know there's a couple of us really felt that God was saying, He wants to heal your hand. But she wouldn't let us try. She wouldn't let us pray for her. She wouldn't let us talk about it. And I can fully understand that now. I didn't then. I was ignorant. But I can understand why for some people, taking that risk is too great a risk. You kind of know where you are with your disabilities. You know, we probably all got different forms of disabilities in different ways. And we kind of get used to them. We get comfortable with them. They become part of who we are and our personality and everything. And somebody comes along and challenges us. There's all sorts of reasons why you're going to say no. And she was terrified at the thought of taking the risk. And we have to be sensitive, obviously, to those issues. But there comes a point where it takes courage to step out. You know, just about anybody who's got anywhere will tell you that they learn from their mistakes. They learn from when it went wrong. You don't learn from getting it right every time. And you get it right when you stay comfortable. When you get out of your comfort area, life gets a bit risky. It seems to me God is always calling us out of our comfort zone and saying, walk with me, let's take risks together. Let's take risks. Remember Simon Peter climbing out of that boat onto choppy water? That's a risk. But how much did he learn? How much did that deepen his relationship with Jesus? One of them out of the whole crowd willing to get out of the boat and take that risk. Remember when he sent out the 72? Another time he sent out the 12 and they came back saying, we've done this and we've done that. Absolutely amazed. Absolutely thrilled with the things they'd achieved in the name of Jesus. But you can imagine the conversation as they're heading out initially when he sends them. And they come to the first village. And there's somebody at the end of the street who's possessed or you know, really ill or whatever it is. You can imagine one disciple saying to the other, You do this one, I'll do the next. It's risky. It's risky. And we're called into that walk where we're called to take risks. And of course, for the woman, she kind of tries to stay anonymous until Jesus calls out, "Who touched me?" And they're all pushing and shoving, but she knows what he's talking about. And then she confesses. And the words that Mark uses, where is it? "And the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet, and trembling with fear, told him the whole truth." You may be trembling with fear, but be honest with God about what it is that you are afraid of, about your situation, about what's going on. We're very good at being polite and using church speak, you know, and using the sort of tried and tested prayers, which keeps God at arm's length. Honesty can be a terrifying thing, because it can get rid of the barriers we put up between us and our God. Remember David's Psalms after the incredible sins that he committed. How many of the Ten Commandments did he break? Murder, adultery, stealing somebody's wife, all of that. The list goes on. But in his Psalms, you see that eventually he comes totally honest with God and opens himself up. And that is not a comfortable experience. You can imagine the trembling with fear there. And we are called to be honest, no matter how fearful we may be. We're called to reach out to him from our feeling of desperation. When you have tried everything and you know that this world is not going to solve your problems because you've tried everything this world promises and offers, and it just doesn't work. It doesn't solve the problem. If that's a hunger inside or a practical thing or whatever it is, we're called to come before God, to reach out to him, to be totally honest. And sometimes, as Angie prayed earlier, it's shame that's holding us back. And it's just a block in our way. And that's a scary place. You can imagine the trembling. But reach out and be honest about what's going on. I remember actually, it was in this very church, I think, many years ago. I was doing an alpha course with somebody. There's bound to be somebody here who remembers this from a different point of view. But I was leading a small group at one of the alpha courses that were in the hall next door. And there was a lady in the group. She made a complaint against me because I'd said this, and I'll say it again. So if you feel that you feel so bad about something that you feel you're going to swear at somebody, swear at God. Leave it with him, because he can cast it as far away as the east is from the west. Only he can forget it. Only he can deal with the sin. That's honesty. If you feel angry or there's an injustice, somebody's so awful they've done this, tell God about it. If you need to scream and shout at him, you scream and shout at him. He prefers your honesty rather than your polite prayers, "Please help Mrs. So-and-so because she needs help." Where really you're thinking, "She's an evil whatever, and she owes me." Hope you can hear where I'm coming from on this. God can deal with the reality. No matter what it is, the anger, the frustration, or the sense of injustice, the shame, the guilt, whatever we're carrying, he's in the business of fixing it. And then he separates it, as I said, as far as the east is from the west. And we say to God, "Remember when I did that?" He says, "No, I don't remember that. That was a sin. It's gone." We have to give it to him. And then finally, we come to the guy who the story starts with, Jairus. Jairus is a man who expects things to be done. He asks someone to do a thing and he'll expect it to be done. Jairus is a man in authority, complete opposite to the woman in the middle of the story. He's at the top of society. He gets the status. But does he send a messenger, a servant, an errand boy to Jesus? He comes himself. I guess many of us, especially the dads here, can relate to Jairus. You know, I've got three daughters, as many of you know. And there have been times in their lives when you just kind of think, God, what's going on? You know, I talked about the one that's getting married a week today. It was only a couple of years ago, two or three years ago, where her current fiancé is Tom. Her previous, this is where it gets murky, her previous fiancé was Tom. At least my dad gets it right every time, because you know that he would be calling the second one by the first one's name, if. So at least God's covered that. But the first one, you know, they had been together. And I have to say that if you'd asked us, you know, what did we think of him, and we were being honest, having just spoken about honesty, it wouldn't be a long list of attributes. It'd be, well, she likes him. That would be probably as good as... But, you know, they were engaged, and then he dumped her. And she was absolutely broken. And she came back to stay with us. And for the best part of a week, she locked herself in her bedroom and cried and cried and cried. And as a parent, you see that and you say, God, what's going on? And she can't see a way out of it. You just feel so much for the hurt and the damage. And daring to trust that God can turn these things around. Current fiancé, Tom number two. No, let's not go for current. Let's go for the husband to be in a week's time. Tom number two. He is so much better for her. If that first marriage had gone ahead, the first thing had gone ahead, she would have carried on repressed. That's probably the best word I can use for it. This one, she's picked up a flute again. She used to be really good with the flute, grade eight. With first Tom, he never wanted her to play it. It stayed put away for all those years. They now sit on our patio, and he's on his guitar, and she's on the flute, and it's beautiful. It's absolutely fantastic. You know, you can only give thanks how God turns what seems the impossible around. You know, and I've got to believe for the others that the impossible situations that they seem to be in, where the future just doesn't look rosy, and from a worldly point of view, you have to believe. But it takes courage to step out and do that. And I've recently been challenged about my own hypocrisy on this. Because my eldest, Jo, she's not very conventional. And in many ways, when it doesn't affect you, you're proud of them for that, because they're not just following the crowds. They're doing their own thing. They're standing out and being individuals. But they decided they wanted a small, quiet wedding. And they gave us about 6 weeks' notice for this wedding. And we sort of said, well, who's invited then? Oh, about eight people. So, oh, what? What do you mean eight? There's a bit more than that now. I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, we just wanted a quiet wedding. We're just close friends, close family. And I started thinking of all the people who'd be upset, all the relatives who, you know, what about your Aunt Teddy? If I'm the one who's going to tell Aunt Ted, you're my sister, that she's not invited, she'll go nuts. And I suddenly started telling her how she should be doing her wedding and who she should be inviting and how, you know, that we couldn't give them any money. They said, no, we don't want money. We're just having a quiet thing. Receptions at our house, don't expect, you know, all the usual stuff. It's just a quiet ceremony at the church at the end of the road. We're going to walk back from the church. And I'm thinking, this is the stuff that is good in a film when it's happening to somebody else, but you're thinking, as a dad, you want all these things. And she doesn't want all those things. And it was my sister, actually, when I rang to explain that she wasn't invited, who pointed out that it's not for dads to interfere and to tell their daughters how to do their wedding. She has dared to do it the way they want to do it. That takes courage. When I look at the kids I teach at school, when I look around at the staff that I work with, when I look at society in general, we want to belong. We want to be one of the crowd. We want to do it the way everybody else does it. Jesus is looking for people who will turn around against the crowd. Jairus shouldn't have got himself. He should have sent a runner. Jairus shouldn't even be thinking about Jesus. That itinerant preacher who's being critical of the established religion, and there you've got the head of the synagogue going himself, believing, daring to believe that this guy can do something for his daughter. Just say the words. And then, of course, when they arrive at the house, and the mourners are there big time. And I think there's such a metaphor here about our obsession with the things of death and how we almost delight in the things of death. If you look around at our society, our culture, there are so many things that the crowds gather, but ultimately at the core of where the crowds are, there is stuff of death. Now, every morning I walk the dog. I usually mention a dog, don't I, on these things. We've got a golden retriever at the moment. We lost our border collie a couple of years ago. Golden retrievers, they are completely different to border collies. Attila the Hun could arrive at the front door in a bad mood and with an axe, and Harvey, the golden retriever, would lick him to death. Because he's just so sociable and friendly, whereas the border collie was basically a psychopath. The retriever is amazing. And every morning, because he's not sheep friendly yet, I can't take him on the moors, so I love it. I walk him along the river through Long Timber Woods in Ivy Bridge. And I was walking back the other day, almost back to the car, it was about 10 to 7, and I could see there's a bloke up on the riverbank ahead of me, acting strangely. Could just tell by his body language that something wasn't right. And I got closer, and he was on his phone, not getting a signal. I could tell by what he was doing with his phone. But at his feet was a huge black dog, and it was just not moving. And he looked at me, and he just sort of said, you could see desperation in his eyes. He just said, "Can you help me?" And I looked at this huge black dog, which wasn't moving, thinking, gulp, what do I do? What do you, you know? Dog first aid isn't my thing. My dog, Harvey, went over to his dog, sniffed him, and then ignored him. Just carried on doing what dogs do. Every other dog he ever meets on that walk, it's like his long-lost friend. It's like they've just met up after a long parting. They have a little doggy party. Every dog he meets, he wants to play, he wants to run around, they've got to do the sniffing thing and all of that. He wants to see if he wants to paddle in the river or have a swim. It's a party. This dog, instantly, he knew this dog was dead. We didn't know that. So we picked the thing up, it was huge, put it in my car. Believe it or not, we found a vet that was open at 7:05 in Ivy Bridge in the morning, and they just confirmed, yeah, it's dead. And that guy was completely, he's a huge bloke, completely distraught, broken he was, messed up my day. But the point, you know, I'm trying to ask God, you know, what's going on? Is there something here? And he says, yeah. He says, there is. Don't spend time with the things of death. You sniff that something's leading to death, you walk away. The rest of society might be crowding around and enjoying it and hailing it and, you know, putting up posters and adverts and giving it high status as part of our culture, but if it's leading to death, you walk away. Don't give it the time of day. Those mourners, he sends them away. I'd love to have been there at that, because you kind of get the sense of Jesus' authority. It says they laughed at him when he says she's not dead. They're in the business of death, they know. And he sends them packing. Because where he is, death isn't. And we're meant to be where he is. We're meant to be following him on that journey of discovery. That risky road. But how much of a risk is it when you are walking with the creator of the universe? The one who overcomes death. The one who says to every one of us, child, arise. Child, arise. Time has raced on. It's gone off past and I've been talking too much. There's three different characters there. And I think at different times in our life, we can relate to each of them. The one who she's at the end of all she knows. She's tried everything. There seems to be no hope for her condition. But she dares to reach out and to be honest. The one who is totally dependent on other people. And that has got to be hard. And there are different ways, you know, it could be a physical thing, but it doesn't have to be, where we're totally dependent on somebody else's strength. And the one who doesn't let his place, his station in life, his status, all he's known is telling people what to do. But when the thing that matters to him is endangered, he knows where to go, to Jesus. And it has to be him. He takes his problem to Jesus. I ask you to just bow your heads for a second.